Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is New York Times op-ed columnist Gail Collins. She's joined in conversation by Inflection Point's Lauren Schiller. And now, join Marcy Glazer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Gail Collins and Lauren Schiller.
When it comes to women of a certain age, Gail Collins' credentials are impeccable. A political columnist for the New York Times since 1995, and the first woman to serve as the paper's editorial page editor, she's the author of three books on the history of women, including America's Women, 400 Years of Dolls, Drudges, Helpmates, and Heroines, and When Everything Changed, The Amazing Journey of American Women from 1960 to the Present. Her latest book, No Stopping Us Now, The Adventures of Older Women in American History, pays tribute to some of our country's most trailblazing women, such as Ann Pollard, the first woman to set foot in the new settlement of Boston in 1630, Mary Fields, who in the 1880s became the first African-American postal worker in the United States, Betty Reed Soskin, who at 98 is our nation's oldest national park ranger, and of course, our own notorious Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Collins's book also chronicles the herky-jerky nature of older women's journey to progress in the United States over the years. It's eye-opening, brimming with new information, and as you'd expect from Gail Collins, a lot of fun. And I just bought it for my 102-year-old grandmother. Joining Gail Collins this evening is Lauren Schiller, creator and host of Inflection Point, a nationally syndicated KALW weekly public radio show and podcast about how women rise up. Let's give both of them a warm welcome to the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco.
All right. It is such a thrill to be here. I wanted to comment, Gail, on how you got from one of your books being about 1960 to the present, which went up to about 2008, to decide, you know what, this time I'm going all the way back to the 1600s.
Yeah, 1960 to the present sounded like a long time. Yeah. During that one. Who knew?
Right, I mean, when everything changed.
Yes,
Is totally, seems like, you know, small potatoes at this point in some ways. So what inspired you to go deep into history to look at older women in America?
Well, I've been doing it. My first book about women was about women in American history, and we could not think of a title for it. It was just, finally we called it America's Women, but that was so pathetic. The subtitle was 400 Years of Dolls, Drudges, Helpmates, and Heroines, which is a desperate attempt to make America's Women sound like a better title. But, and while I was doing that one, I just came across a bunch of stuff that I wanted to go back and look at again. And one at some point along the way I came across was this letter from one of the very early columnists. And columnists, yes. The columnists who discovered America were amazing.
Did you fact check that?
The colonists, when they were first here, they were all guys. And so they're writing back to England saying, you know, please send us some women, please, please, please. And they wrote down their description of an ideal wife who was a woman who was civil and under 50 years of age. So I thought, wow, you know, that. And then I was wandering through some other point, I guess, when everything changed, and I ran across that famous hair coloring ad from the early 70s that said, you're not getting older, you're getting better. And I looked at it, and the copy within that said, these days, any woman over 25 is old. And I thought, holy moly, wow. And you look right now, and there's Ruth Bader Ginsburg at the gym, and they're running the Supreme Court, and everybody's applauding. And I thought, wow, what makes all this stuff go up and down like this? And it seemed like a fun thing to look into.
Yeah.
So here I am.
So could you possibly give us the sort of the ups and downs of women in America? In
everything. No
problem. From the 1600s to today? Like, what's the 60-second recap?
may take 2 minutes. However,
okay, you get 2 minutes.
Well, there were two things. One was scarcity, as we've just seen. If you were the only woman coming into some town in the Wild West, really, you could be 95, and they would be throwing themselves at you and make no difference whatsoever. But the other thing that seemed to me such a big pattern once I looked at it was whether they had an economic role. Women who have an economic role are judged the way men are judged. And women who are seen as only mothers are pretty much out to pasture once their children are grown. And that was the great, great cosmic difference that I saw. And it came and went and came and went. And I won't tell you any more right now because that's my 2 minutes, but we'll go back to it.
No, you've got more time. Keep going. What happened? I mean, you talk about with World War II how everything mm-hmm. really shifted.
It shifted. You start, look, 2 seconds to the colonies. In the colonies, wives were all farm wives, and they're growing vegetables, making candles, making... I just wove 33,000 balls of yarn this year. I mean, just went on and on. The stuff that they could do, creating wealth. And everybody knew that the housewife was creating all this wealth, and young women wanted to come and hang out with them so they could learn how to do it. So at that period, it was a great period for being an older woman. Then when everybody moved to the cities, and middle-class women had a much shrunken role that had nothing to do with economics, that was suddenly when, if your kids are gone, why are you still here? But, you know, it was very, very, very cruel and mean. Mm-hmm. And then as you go back and forth in history, whenever there's an economic call for older women, then they become very popular. And during World War II was the absolute perfect example. You had all the guys are gone, and young women with children really resisted the idea of going to work. So there was everybody, a clarion call, and all eyes turned to older women. Here they are, oh my God. And you suddenly not just had Rosie the Riveter stories, but you had these stories about Josephine, the 80-year-old riveter. My God, is she great. And I remember reading one in a magazine at the time that was going around during the war saying, "We were so touched today, we went to a restaurant and saw a 65-year-old woman carrying a tray of dishes with a gleam of happiness in her blue eyes." I'm not sure about the gleam of happiness part. But that was the moment when women, older women, nobody complained about them at all. They were the heroines because they were doing all the work.
Yeah. Well, what you tell a story in the book, flashing forward really to the 90s, I think it is, about some guys you were interviewing in Connecticut about what they were looking for in a woman.
Yeah. This was the humongous discovery that I made somewhere along the way. My greatest thought was about the economic participation of women. And after World War II, the economy exploded and everybody thought they could become middle class. Everybody's going to the suburbs, they're getting their own houses, their kids are going to go to college, we're going to go on vacations. It was a humongous explosion of expectation for family life. And then the 70s came, and all that kind of, you know, the oil, you remember a lot of you, I'm sure, the oil boycott, this awful, awful economy of the 70s. And suddenly, many, many, many families could no longer support the life they thought they needed to live with one income. And that was really the absolute change, because suddenly all the women who had been consigned to the role of mom and nothing else were drawn back into the workforce, and younger women started thinking about what their role would be. And my favorite story about that period is, it was actually later in the late 70s or the 80s, but I was at a college in New Britain, Connecticut, and for some reason I'm talking to an entire room full of guys, and I do not know how exactly I got there. I was doing a woman's book tour, but so they were lovely guys, and I said to them, "What do you look for in a wife?" And nobody was going to say to me a really hot woman who I really remember. So, so they all said a really good personality. And I said, "Oh, that's nice." And then one kid in the back said, "And a good earner." And they all said, "Yes, oh my God, yes, and a good earner, got to be a good earner." And I thought then, wow, this is a whole new vision. You know, guys really need their wives to be good earners. And women are being integrated into the economy in the same way. And they're going to get old in a totally different way.
You know what's so interesting to me about that is that why does the gender wage gap still exist?
Very, very, very good question. It goes on forever, too. You know, one of the great things after the invention of the pill, one of the fastest things that happened
birth was... Birth control pill, I take you.
The birth control pill, sorry. Many pills, but this is the one I was
thinking. We were talking about Oxy earlier, so just to clarify.
That pill. Well, after the invention of the birth control pill, suddenly the number of women in graduate school, law school, medical school skyrocketed because you could suddenly control and make sure you were not going to be getting pregnant and having a baby while you were doing your preparation for your career. Stupendous numbers. Now there are more women in law school and medical school than there are men. And the income and average of doctors and lawyers has dropped. What does this mean? It's a pattern that goes on and on and on and on and on. I believe we will overcome it at some point. Another problem is that women often like to go into the helping professions, which instantly, when you hear the word helping, you know they're not going to be making very much money. It's mm-hmm. just, and because of that, they want to teach, they want to, you know, go do social work, they want to help out in different ways, and those are their income from those professions are not as high, and good for them. So a little bit of both going
yeah.
on there.
And then, right, and then when there is a male profession, like teaching, yeah. that women started to take over... It happens over and over again. I just think it's bizarre that they want good earners, but they only want them to make, I don't know, 72 cents for every dollar they make.
Well, not the husbands. I do not know anybody who believes more in equality of pay opportunity than the husbands of working wives. They are really for it 100%.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay, so older women do better when they can generate more money. That's mm-hmm. one of the things that you told us. And our women's power seems to fluctuate depending on, you know, what's happening with the economy overall, how much we're needed, but also who's got political power. I mean, are those the two main drivers of where women do or do not have power? Is who's in charge politically, and how much are they needed economically?
And the political part is very interesting because you can't quite figure out where it goes with women. Women got the vote in 1920, and they had a vision of a new society that would be created with the women's vote, in which there'd be clinics for poor women and their children. There'd be all of these things happening to make society better, kinder, more womanlike in orientation. And none of it happened at all. Women voted like their husbands. Warren Harding was elected president instantly, and we got prohibition. That was about it. And so voting by itself is not nearly enough to make a difference. You have to be an aggressive voter, which we're seeing more and more among women, that women are inclined to vote differently from their husbands, their fathers, their brothers, everybody else, much more than they were, say, 10, 20, 30 years ago. And that's a real lever of power. We'll see where that takes everybody.
So can we talk about prohibition, since you brought that up?
Nobody has said, can you talk about prohibition for a long time? I really love this. Thank you.
Who here wants to talk about prohibition? Show of hands? Okay, we got one. Okay, we got one person who wants. Okay, so we're going to talk about it for you. But you talk in the book about how prohibition, while it was pushed by older women, was actually really bad for older women, because what it meant is that their husbands were now going to these illicit nightclubs and hanging out with the flappers, who were generally in their 20s. And
it
so
was very unfortunate.
It kind of had a bad backlash.
It was the whole liquor thing was very weird, because it really did separate men from women before prohibition. You know, one of the reasons women were so antagonistic to it. Well, one was that truly in poor neighborhoods, the saloons desperately tried to drag men in on payday and take away all their money. So, I mean, it was a legitimate crusade. But beyond that, middle-class women didn't drink. And after dinner, and sometimes on weekends and whatever, their husbands and the men would go away places and drink and sort of leave them behind. And it was a real division between the sexes, and women resented it and thought it was bad. And so that kind of propelled the way, too, right along the way. And then there we were. And nobody liked it once it came. It really did not work out well at all. And it's true that then middle-aged women, housewives, mothers, are not going to be going off to the speakeasies to be hanging out and drinking. So if the men go, they are going to be meeting a whole new group of young women who are hanging out there. And women got very paranoid, housewives, at the time. You know, what the hell is going on? Where are these men going? And even if they weren't going anywhere, they were still looking at their husbands, you know, like, is this going to happen? What's happening here? So it didn't work out nearly the way people thought it would.
Yeah. Well, there were eventually some good things that came out of women getting the vote and women actually getting political power. So
I do not want to say this was not a good thing to do, by the way, but yeah, go ahead.
That it was not a good thing to do?
To give women the vote. No, it was really, really, really
It just
really,
was sort of
really
a slow cook, right?
Yeah.
It was like
it wasn't nearly the revolutionary moment that women thought it was going to
yeah.
be.
Yeah. But eventually, out of having women in power, we got Social Security. We got better labor laws.
The New Deal. Eleanor Roosevelt. Oh, my God.
Yeah, let's talk about Eleanor Roosevelt.
Eleanor Roosevelt, I think, had the greatest middle age of any woman in American history by far. I mean, God help us. She's all over the place. She is visiting places that nobody else at the top of government has ever gone to, ever, to see poor black families, to see Appalachian families. She's going to see the troops overseas. She's driving around by herself. It was driving the Secret Service so crazy that they taught her how to use a revolver. So there she's in her car with a revolver going to see people in Appalachia. I just, oh my God, what a woman. And because of her influence and because of people who are hanging out with her and because of people who had begun to move into positions of power locally. Anyway, you got the New Deal women like Frances Perkins, who was the person you most remember as being responsible for Social Security. So no badness at all in that development, I would say.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to talk about the parallels in that moment in time to the moment in time that we're experiencing now.
Wow. Okay.
Well, just in terms of...
So there's Franklin Roosevelt. And then,
okay. Not those guys, the women. we have a historic number of women in Congress now, and they're in positions
yes.
to make a lot of change. Mm-hmm. And I think we all tend to get frustrated. I mean, clearly we've got, you know, an issue in the White House that is preventing a lot of things from happening, but that we get frustrated with the pace of change, that why does it take so... Now we've got all these women, so how can we see more things happen more quickly around education and healthcare yeah. and, you know, the so-called more feminine interests.
You really wonder if we had a different president what this last election would have brought forward. But things are so crazy now that, I mean, just the ability to get up in the morning is about everything they can accomplish. And I find Nancy Pelosi very interesting. People complain constantly, why isn't she doing more? Why isn't she doing more? But she is handling this thing that's happening now, you know? I can't imagine anybody else doing, any guy up there, you know, that I've watched doing it, cannot conceive of them doing it anywhere better. You can, you know, you see the committee chairman, the guys. I mean, it's just not, they were not going to do any better than Nancy Pelosi. She's really controlled this thing, handled Donald Trump as well as a human being possibly could. And I, you know, like to think that's part of the future. And once we get past this time, it'll be very interesting to see what these very large number of women moving into Congress, although still a minority and hardly any women governors, there's still a long, long way to go. Still, see what happens next. It's going to
yeah.
be great.
Yeah. And they are, I mean, we were talking about this earlier, they are, the majority of women are Democrats. There's
yes.
very few female Republicans.
Very few. It's amazing how they could even manage to avoid having more women. It's just incredible. Gosh darn.
Imagine what could get done, though, if there were more women Republican politicians.
True. But, you know, they do work until this recent unpleasantness of the last couple of years, the women in Congress worked together very well. They had their, you know, regular things they would do. They would do softball games together. They would go out to dinner together. They had their own special place where they would hang out. And they were capable of behaving in a much more bipartisan manner than the guys were. And if things had... I think the place where they did... I probably still, if they still get to do it, the place that they hung out was the Strom Thurmond Room, which I just find so... The idea that Strom Thurmond gave his name to this just tickles me so. But, you know, once this passes, I just... You know, we'll see what happens. It's going to be a whole new thing, for
yeah.
sure.
I like the affirmative way that you just said, once this passes. All things must pass.
All things.
You're listening to New York Times op-ed columnist Gail Collins, whose new book is No Stopping Us Now, A History of Older Women in America. She's joined in conversation by Inflection Point's Lauren Schiller on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Let's talk about you for a minute. You're a woman with power. I mean, you write this call. Look at you. You're sitting on the stage in front of all these people.
Thank you.
I feel the glow of you right here. And you write your column every week for the New York Times, and you have the opportunity to sway a lot of public opinion. And I mean, is this such a weird question to ask? But do you think in those terms? Like, if I write this and this happens, I have this power, and how must I use it?
Not exactly. And my thing has been, I've been a columnist for a really long time. Before the Times, I was at the New York Newsday, and then the Daily News before that. And somewhere along the line in the Daily News period, I was writing local columns about local government. And at that point, New York's local government was so bad. Oh, my God, it was terrible. And I'd write these columns, every couple of days saying, oh, my God, look what they did now. Oh, my Lord, it's getting worse and worse and worse. And I would go on and on like that, trying to rile up, indignation and fury. But after a while, I was thinking, oh, my God, basically I'm causing people to get up and want to throw themselves out the window. There's got to be a different way to do this where I can tell people what's happening without depressing them mortally. So at that point, I sort of tried to make the columns more fun to read. So that my goal has been for a long time now to just get people to know about stuff in a way that doesn't make them suicidal.
I mean, it seems, so far so good. I chuckle every time I read one of your columns, even though, what you're conveying is just so horrible.
We're getting the votes in now, and we have a contest now, name the worst cabinet member.
Yeah. But,
many, many votes are coming in, I've got to tell you.
Well, let's talk about what it means to be old. I mean, this is a question that's in question, right? This is a certain age.
And you cannot argue about your age now, lie about it now that we have Wikipedia. I mean, you're just stuck. Whatever age you are, you really are for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's no good answer to the question, how old are you? Or you look younger than I thought you were. Or you look older than I thought you were. Yeah, that used to be a compliment, but now not so much.
No, I'm 73, by the way. That's the story of this.
Well, okay, so one of the things that I found in the book is that in the 1950s, only about 3% of the population was over 65.
Very tiny bit, yeah. And the amount is just, I trust your numbers because I've completely gone blind.
I got it from somewhere.
But it was tiny, and it's exploded. And one of the reasons I think it's so important to talk about women maintaining careers and men too, in their later years, is because there's going to be so many of us very soon. This world is not going to be able to support us unless we do more earning on the side to try to keep things going a bit, because it's just, and the number of people over 90 is skyrocketing. Most of them are women. And it's going to get more and more and more so because, thank you, the medical profession. Which, by the way, doing history, I have to say, teeth. I think back about history. Oh, my God, there were no teeth. Nobody had any teeth. They found the body of a woman at Jamestown just a few years ago when they were digging around, and she was about 30 years old, and she had 5 teeth. That was all. So when I think about history, I do wander off, and I'm sorry, I just changed the subject completely. But every once in a while, I think, my God, teeth. Oh, my Lord in heaven. This is so amazing. We've all got our teeth. Yeah.
Well, right, there's been a lot of medical advancements since we started.
Even more profound than that, but I just... Sorry,
we'll get to plastic surgery and all the other stuff in a few minutes. Hair dye. I know that's not a medical procedure, but... is retirement passé now? I mean, is that not a thing anymore? I mean, if 65 was the retirement age, I mean...
Well, many people do retire at 65. And to be fair, many, many people look forward to retiring at 65. It's not like the entire world is out there saying, let me stay in this job for another 10 years.
Yeah.
This is what I really want to do. But the vision that when you stop doing, if you stop doing what you were doing when you turn 65 or whenever, that you're then going to go home and, you know, sit around is, I think, really passé. There are just so many things people are doing now. There's so many people who are working as volunteers. There's so many people doing community service. There's so many people who are just going out and doing things they always wanted to do, you know, take a boat around the world or whatever, that they couldn't do otherwise. But that's the vision. I mean, the thing is that you don't have that sense of, okay, we're done now, we're going to go home and it's all over.
Yeah. I mean, because you get to be sticking around for another 30, 40 years.
Damn straight. Yeah.
We've got to come up with a good routine. I mean, it's also in this time, it seems like a great opportunity to get involved in, say, some activism.
Yeah,
right? And
exactly.
And thinking about women throughout history who have been involved in activism and bridging that gap between the younger activists and the older activists, how those two worldviews might come together or push apart. And that's something that you talk about.
Can I tell my Elizabeth Cady Stanton story?
Yes.
This is one of my favorite stories. And this is before the Civil War. And women in the North were the ones who were very, very conscious of the evils of slavery, I think more than the men were there. They were very into the idea that it was a woman's issue because you're talking about families being broken up and young girls being at the mercy of slave owners, and it became a very passionate issue. But you couldn't go out and talk about it in public because the idea of women speaking out in public was just not accepted. They would throw stones at you. They would burn down your auditorium. They thought that you were all promiscuous. If you were to speak out in public, you were a harlot. That was kind of the thought that was going around. And so nobody did it. You really did not have any women getting out of, and even African-American women who wanted to speak out against slavery were really discouraged by their communities in many parts of the North. So Elizabeth Cady Stanton is right there in this point, and she's dying to go out and talk about this stuff. So she suddenly announces, well, I'm going to come out because I'm a grandmother. Gray hair, you know, looking kind of dumpy, wearing frumpy clothes here. I am a grandmother. I'm going to come and talk to you about grandmothery things, our boys in our home, and I'll throw in a little bit about slavery, maybe, and a little bit about women's rights. And I've got ideas about divorce reform that I made. And she got away with it. And she went around the country giving speeches all the time, sleeping overnight in railroad stations when she couldn't get a train, playing cards with soldiers on her way from one town to the other. She got away with it all because she presented herself as a grandmother. And her friends saw this going on, and suddenly they started writing odes to menopause. Oh, happy day! We get to go out! This is all great. And it was a great liberation, and it was liberation through gray hair, basically.
So the menopause thing comes up a lot for obvious reasons. but that it either is, you know, going to make you sex crazy or sex neutral or completely be the beginning of the end. I mean, can you talk about some of the things that you learned about the
change? Doctors didn't discover menopause until, you know, in the 1800s. They just did not occur and they didn't care. When they did discover it, they instantly decided it was terrible and it led to your death or insanity or something. It was just, it was never popular. And when doctors did start to think about it, they started to think about ways to avoid it. They started with chimpanzee glands, allegedly at least, injecting women with chimpanzee glands to save them from menopause and keep going. And of course, that didn't work, but you did, as time went on, get to what led to hormone replacement therapy, which for, you know, 20 years was the absolute thing that was going on in this country. Tons and tons and tons of women were doing it. And that was all about eliminating the evils of menopause. And it took all that time, really until they realized that hormone replacement therapy was bad for you and you can't do it anymore for long periods of time, before people were really ready to sit down and talk about, well, hey, this is a normal part of life. You can just do that and move on and everything is fine. It was It was a bad moment for the medical profession that went on for a long period of time, but I think it's pretty well over now. It's been a long time since I have heard anybody say, oh, my God, I'm going through menopause. My life is over. It's been forever. I don't know when this happened.
I just hear, oh, my God, I'm going through menopause. I'm sweating all the time.
That one does still come up. I've got to say, that's true.
So on that topic, the amount of work...
I'm sorry, guys, whoever is out here. It's just
hey, you know what? It's just it's part of the package.
Thank you.
Okay. There's also, I love all the stories about hair dye and the reactions to women who dyed their hair, the horrible dye that was actually available when it first came out. And, and even today, women of a certain age or women who are going gray have to make this vital decision. Mm. I mean, it's really a life-altering decision. Am I going to dye my hair?
Well, my friend Nora Ephron said that the history of women superseding the limitations of age was not about feminism or about better life through exercise. It was all about hair dye. And I was totally into that idea. And I sort of grabbed it because it really is in many ways true that if you have the choice of deciding whether or not you're going to go gray, and either one is a perfectly logical choice, it does create sort of an end to that whole idea that there's a particular point in life when all women go gray, and that's a marker, because clearly 2/3 of the women are not having that marker anymore.
Right.
There was a 10-year period, I think it was from the beginning to the end of the 60s, but maybe the 70s, when the first time that women could, that was really easy to do hair coloring, you could do it at home, it was easy to go to a hair dye or a hair shop and get it done. 7% of women used hair coloring at the beginning of that decade, and by the end, they had to take hair color off American passports because you couldn't tell anymore. You had no idea what color people's hair really was. So it just eliminated. It's a big thing. And in the early days, women, first of all, it was against the law in many states, allegedly, to dye your hair, or at least they tried to pass laws. State legislatures will do anything, basically. And there was a long period of state legislatures talking about banning or making it illegal to dye your hair because the theory was you could trick men into marrying you by looking younger than you really were. And, the dyes were so terrible then that nobody would have been fooled anyway. And if you used them, your hair would fall out or you'd get mercury poisoning. It just was not a reliable thing to do for anybody. But there was this paranoia on the part of state legislatures and people, guys in general, that somehow women would be able to trick you into thinking that they were much younger than they really were.
You know, there's got to be a politician who just had a terrible experience, and he's like, I am not letting this happen to any of my other male
friends.
State
Senator Fred, and he told everybody about it. It was horrible.
Well, I was also thinking about, I can't remember if this is in your book or not, but the quality of mirrors used to be not that good.
Right.
And if you've ever stayed in an old house or whatever and you try and do your makeup, pluck your eyebrows, forget about it. So, but as the quality of mirrors got better, I'm guessing that also intersected with the proliferation of magazines and all of these different ways that you could beautify yourself and all the makeup that was available to do it with.
It's absolutely true, and it was very fast that suddenly this all turned over and women went, hey, this could happen, that could happen. And then once it became possible, every magazine in the entire universe was warning you, if you don't use blah or blah or blah, you are going to look like such a hag, you will never be able to go outside again. There was one ad I really loved. It was from, I think, the 40s, maybe the 50s, in which a young girl is saying to her mother, Mom, you're looking so young these days because of blah, blah. And Mom looked really young because she had exactly the same face as her daughter in the ad.
Well, in addition to the kind of the epiphany around the mirror, I was also just thinking about how much, these magazines, many of them, especially as the years went on, were run by women.
Yep.
And women perpetuating these beauty standards, which are impossible for most real people who don't have Photoshop or a stylist and a makeup person and a fitness trainer and yada, 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 to actually live up to. And that it has caused, and you can see I'm wearing lipstick. I get my hair cut just the other day. But that it has caused us women to spend so much time and money worrying about these things and also being judged by them, and that it has been perpetuated, in a sense, by other women, women who had the possibility to change the way we think about ourselves.
Yeah, it's a great business. And, I worry about cosmetic surgery, that the places at which it goes to, crazy lengths, and you just see poor women, cutting themselves up every year to try to look more and more young, and I find that very disturbing. But I have to say, I've sort of gotten used to the cosmetic thing. I mean, and I see a lot of guys who I just think, well, if you had the opportunity, yeah, you might want to do this too. So it's not my biggest worry anyway in the cosmic scheme of things.
Right. Okay, fair enough. So I'm gonna totally shift. We're moving away from hair dye and makeup and all of that into the civil rights movement.
Fantastic.
where women did, when they went to march, dress quite beautifully and wear their hat and their lipstick, mm-hmm. and you even have a story about lipstick and suits, maybe.
Yeah, the Women's March for Peace in particular, that was like the first really anti-war, anti-nuclear proliferation movement that was it was created by middle-class housewives. And their idea was that if you marched around wearing like a shirtwaist dress and maybe even a mink coat and high heels, picketing the White House, that you would confuse people and think, then they'd cause them to think, maybe mothers really do care about these issues and it's not really the three crazy people down the street. And it worked to some extent. And for a long time, younger women in the movement were always being yelled at for not coming in with the right clothes on and stuff like that, because they thought that was a really important part of the story. And when it came to the civil rights movement, can I just tell one civil rights thing that it's just...
Yeah, absolutely, that preceded, I mean, that was leading up to the civil rights. Yes, go.
The thing about the civil rights movement that, and I thought so much about the trajectory of African-American women, and which was different because they were working all the time mostly as domestics, but... When you got to the civil rights movement, when we think about the civil rights movement, we think about young people getting, getting killed or risking their lives down south, and then we think about Martin Luther King, and all the other men who were leaders. But if you look at, say, the beginning of the movement, the first person that most Americans heard about was Rosa Parks, who was a middle-aged woman. And then that gave birth to, when she refused to go to the back of the bus, that gave birth to the Montgomery bus boycott, which was really the thing that caused America for the first time to think, for the first time really focus in on this. And the Montgomery bus boycott was organized by middle-aged black women. They were the ones who had been out in the community forever doing social work, helping people, taking care of stuff that was going on, working on the schools, registering people to vote. And they were the ones that had those kind of connections who could go right in there and organize people very quickly. And nobody gave them any credit. And Andrew Young said that it was because they were too much like their mothers, so they therefore didn't want to do it. But nobody has celebrated the work of older black women in the civil rights movement nearly enough.
And he specifically said that about Ella Baker.
Yes, Ella Baker was my hero. Oh, my God, Ella Baker.
Tell her story.
I don't know if you have any... Ella Baker was a great organizer in the civil rights movement, and she started out and she spent her most heroic years working with young people, black and white, in the South, trying to give them a vision of community organizing that didn't involve just having a big strike and then everybody goes away, but organizing the whole community so that people are able to take up the cause themselves and set their own goals. And it was hard to do because, of course, the kids wanted to come in, but she spent her great years working on that kind of organization. And she would go from town to town. She would spend all of her nights on trains, going from town to town, sitting, listening all night long to young people talking, trying to help them by listening to them, think about ways to move forward. They called her their Gandhi. She did this when she had terrible asthma, and all these kids smoked the whole night long. And she would sit there with respirators, listening with the oxygen mask on, listening for hours and hours and hours and hours patiently to these kids talking in order to help them to move forward. I think she's the great unsung heroine, hero of the civil rights movement forever.
Yeah.
Ella, oh my God.
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is New York Times op-ed columnist Gail Collins, whose new book is No Stopping Us Now, A History of Older Women in America. She's joined in conversation by Inflection Point's Lauren Schiller. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So Ella Baker was a middle-aged woman who went and hung out with young people and helped them rise up. But sometimes the young people don't necessarily want the old people around.
Don't trust anyone over 30. Has
exactly.
Oh, my God, yeah. I must admit I was in college for that. And we actually did trust many people over 30, you know, people who are our professors, men and women, and, you know, our lawyers. But it was just so cool to say that you just did for a while.
We would say in high school all the time to our parents. You wrote in your book, it was about the 1950s. In the 1950s, the Population Reference Bureau was a research book that warned that the country could be taken over by elderly women. Since their number were increasing so much faster than that of the men. In terms of voting power, ownership of land, and corporate equities, the U.S. could be seen on the road toward a gerontomatriarchy, control by aging females.
Ready to go. Okay.
What happened?
Worst things could happen in the world. I can name one right now really fast. Well, part of it is went with women's suffrage, and why it didn't work out the way you expected is that women's interests are so intermingled with their husbands, their sons, their brothers, that it's very seldom that you see for any prolonged period of time women separating themselves from men and saying, you know, we're just going to do this on our own. You know, it's just not going to ever happen. And that was part of it. And the whole older women taking over the world thing, which I'm sort of looking forward to, has clearly been a lot slower than some people might have expected. But I think it's just paranoia. I mean, that there's just a ton of that out there. People, you know, being statisticians and poll takers, becoming paranoid about stuff that they didn't need to become paranoid about.
Okay, so remember the statistic about people over 65 being such a small percentage of the population. So apparently by 2034, there will be more people 65 and older than there are people under 18.
The population is just exploding, you know, all the way up. And as I think I said before, the answer to that, one of the answers is that older people are not going to be able to drop out anyway, even if they want to. They're going to have to chip in there, do stuff to help keep the rest of the country going. I mean, it's our responsibility, for heaven's sake. You just can't let these things slide and say, I've done mine, I'm gone, this is all you. But so that's one of the reasons I just see this incredible change in what's going to be happening.
Yeah. Well, there is you'll probably tell me that it's always been this way, but there is a movement around activism from mothers. And often, you know, mothers in their 40s whose kids are old enough, they're at school and they have time available to push forward things around ending gun violence. I mean, Mothers Against Drunk Driving is the first one that I... Yeah, okay, ending gun violence, yes. Thank you. I'm thinking specifically of Shannon Watts from Moms Demand Action, and then Moms Clean Air Force is a great environmental group. Mm-hmm. But Mothers Against Drunk Driving is the first one that I have a memory of. Yeah. And just thinking about these women who are old enough to have a skill set and a focus and something that they want to see change and not just go along with the status quo. I mean, that is such a huge asset to our country.
It's always been this way.
Yes.
Not really, but there have been so many people like that who have talked about that throughout our history.
Yeah.
Jane Addams was the famous leader of the first social work movement, really, among women in this country. And, you know, she worked until, you know, she really was almost ready to die. And and wrote many articles as she got older about how older women were getting back in there, and they were doing, it was all volunteer work, but it was very serious volunteer work in their communities. They were starting women's clubs that everybody thought were, oh my God, they're going to be writing papers about Julius Caesar and his wife's dresses or whatever. It's going to be really silly. And very fast, they went from the, we're going to do study groups to, we are going to do prison reform. We're going to go and help working women in working class, working women. We're going to do stuff to pasteurize milk, for God's sake. So this has been a movement that comes and goes and comes and goes. But I think it's coming again now. You do really see... although I talked to Anna Quinlan about that, who's been working for Planned Parenthood for a thousand years, just the rock of Planned Parenthood. And she said that she finds now that so many older women are still working, that their volunteers more and more tend to be younger women who are trying to get college credit for it or something like that, which is a very weird and strange thought that never occurred to me before, but I'm just putting it out there because if Anna Quinlan says it, it's probably true.
And those interns should get paid. Well, one of the things that I, the main thing that I explore on my show is how women rise up. So since you've studied 400 years of women rising up, I mean, is there an answer out there? I mean, could we just
there
put,
are many, but
put
I can tell you one from my yeah. very own life that when people ask me a lot, how did you get to be the editorial page editor at the Times or whatever? And the answer is basically
First woman to do it.
There were some before me, but they were all guys. There were many before me, but they were all guys. And I have to tell you, this is totally in passing, and I'm sorry I'm getting off the subject, but at the Times, there's a room where the editorial board meets, and they do all their deliberations and discussions. And when I was around, there were pictures on the wall, it was in the old building, of Henry Raymond, who was the first editor and editorial page editor, and a few of the other really famous editorial page editors. And of course, they're all guys. And I used to, once in a while, if I was feeling really sassy, I just go in the middle of the day and I'd say, guys, I've got your job. And it just knocked me out. I really just always enjoyed that happening. But I wanted to tell a story that has... I was talking so much about how the economy changed what happened with women and everything else, but when... It was also the women who changed what happened with women. Women who filed lawsuits and who went on strike for equal opportunity. And they were almost never the people who got the rewards. At the time, as the women who, it was before I got there, but as a day that I think the publisher or the editor, it was a while back, posted a thing saying, we have three new openings for editors, and any guy that's interested should just come over here and apply, or something like that. But whatever it was, it just drove the women crazy, because they had all had desires. They had hopes and dreams of becoming, say, foreign editor or national editor or whatever. And they were all getting shunted away to assistant travel page editor or whatever. And they were so angry, and they fought. They started fighting and protesting and threatening lawsuits and terrifying the management until all these changes were made. And I guarantee you right now, the New York Times is the most diversity-conscious place I have certainly ever worked. They're very, very conscious of that. But this change, when it happened, didn't help those women, because they had been spending so much of their lives fighting for this stuff that they were like, she was the travel editor, travel deputy for 15 years. What the hell? We're not, and you know, they were older and they'd gotten in everybody's face. So they were sort of thought of as a pain. The people who got all the rewards were people like me who walked in right after that. And we were the ones who got all of the opportunities. And I know so many of these women. And the thing about them that just knocks me out is that they weren't bitter about it, they were so happy that they had done something that had opened up these opportunities. When I got to be editorial page editor, they were thrilled. None of them ran around saying, I could have done that, for God's sake. I didn't have the chance. It's not fair. And that, to me, is the definition of a great heart. Somebody who takes joy in somebody else getting the thing they fought for that they didn't get. And that's what these women were like. And I never pass up a chance to talk about them.
That's it. That's the answer, right? We help each other step up.
You help each other.
You know, when I first got the book, I thought to myself, no stopping us now. Is that ironic or sincere? But I feel like by the end of reading the book and this conversation, I think it's our rallying cry.
It is totally sincere. I mean, I just look at the history, and when I think that I got to live through the point in history that changed the entire way women survive in Western civilization, that changed the role of women, the role of men relating to women, that had gone on forever. It changed in my lifetime, and I got to see it happen. How can you not be optimistic when you think about something like that?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to ask one more question before the audience starts. Could you feel it? Could you feel it as each change happens? I mean, obviously, as a little baby, like, you're maybe not feeling things, but, you know, as you, as a tween and then in your 20s, 30s, and so on.
No, I was really completely out to lunch about it. I had gone mostly to all-girls schools, and so, I mean, you know, and with Catholic schools, so really the male thing did not enter the equation a whole lot at all as you were coming along. And then when I was in college, we were having the free speech movement, and it was a very open movement, and I felt, you know, kind of fine about that. So it really wasn't until I got to graduate school, and there were a lot of other women organizing around women's issues, that I mean, I had no idea. And there were no women faculty members in the graduate school where I was at UMass at that time. But it had never occurred to me. I was so stupid and so dumb. And I'm just every day thankful that when I was there, I ran into all of these amazing women and on throughout my life. They were all always way ahead of me. And it was just a privilege to kind of come up behind them and learn stuff from them.
Yeah. All right. Thank you for sharing that. Do we have questions?
Thank you so much for your comments and so on and so forth. Yes, we're all doing better. But there's still such fear and hatred of women that comes out in the elections. For example, now, can you really, you know, she doesn't look presidential. Mm-hmm. She doesn't look like a leader. Her voice is not what I'm used to. How do you think we're going to deal with all that?
Well, when I try to think positively about this, when I think about older women in particular, you have three candidates for the Democratic nomination who are 70 or older. And the one that nobody talks about age about is Elizabeth Warren, because she's just such a dynamo. I mean, nobody, they talk constantly about Joe Biden's age, Bernie Sanders' age, but never about Elizabeth Warren's age. And that's, in its own way, a little bit of a movement anyway. You know, people, the great accomplishment for me always, I've thought, that Hillary Clinton made to the national movement forward was that she got people used to the idea of women running for president in a real way. And that, I mean, something they'd never seen before, ever. And she got people totally used to it. They got used to and the majority of them voted for her, excuse me. But, And that's you see at this last election, in so many places, the Democrats were realizing their best chance of moving forward, their best chance of picking up seats, was to find young progressive women who had been working in those communities who were ready to take the next leap up. So I have great faith. I may not be around for it all, but I have absolutely no doubt that women are going to continue to move forward to get, and if the Republican Party is going to save itself, the way it's going to do it is by bringing more women in to run for office, to be in Congress, to be in the Senate, to be presidential candidates. And so I'm very optimistic, but there's a lot of really weird little puddles right now that we're going to have to get around.
Yeah. I might just comment on Elizabeth Warren and no one talking about her age. What is also refreshing is that no one is talking about her hair.
That's true. Never comes up. Never comes up.
Till now.
And I find I find it very interesting that conservative men of good faith are terrified of Elizabeth Warren. It's not that they look down on her or that they think she's dumb or anything else. They are scared to death that she could actually be elected and bring, you know, her priorities to bear. I do a conversation with Bret Stephens, who's supposed to be the right, and I do the left back and forth. And it's always been a problem because we're supposed to fight, and he hates Donald Trump more than I do. So, you know, it's just kind of, there's a lot of agreement going on there. But I always find if I really need him to get fighting about something, I just drop Elizabeth Warren in there.
One of the things I love about your columns is your sense of humor, and I'd love to hear you comment about the role that humor plays in diffusing tension, getting women into places where normally they wouldn't necessarily be accepted, either in the historical figures that you have written about or in your own life.
And you look through some of the people that I've you know sort of looked at and followed. I mean, women have a great sense of humor. Many of these great women. Elizabeth Cady Stanton was really underestimated when it came to the humor part of the whole thing. But they never got credit for that because you couldn't. I mean, they were so obsessed in moving forward that you couldn't pretend to not be as serious as you needed to be in order to take the next step. But that's the great glory of right now. We get to get, you know, before I was writing a column, Maureen Dowd was writing a column, and she did that a lot. She figured out how to do it way before I did. And Ellen Goodman before that was... it's been forever, but it's better now. It's more fun now. Mm-hmm.
You're great, and my question for you is, I've noticed lately with movies and musicals like Hamilton, to take somebody from history and bring them forth in manners that a lot of people can absorb very easily. So have you ever thought about taking your work and bringing it to a more populist platform of some sort? Okay. I think it'd be great.
I'm thinking about a musical about Martha Washington right now. Oh, my God.
I was thinking Gail Collins, the musical. Oh.
I'm Martha. Okay. I'm going to go with Martha right away there. And yeah, I mean, that's the idea that women will not... And in entertainment in general, if I get to say one last thing, it's that entertainment has been very slow to follow the progress of older women and the rest of parts of society. I bet many of you knew that Dustin Hoffman was only 2 years younger than Anne Bancroft when they made The Graduate together. And even to this day, if you put a bunch of men and women the same age together, the women are going to be cast as the mothers really, really frequently. And when this comes up, then somebody will always say, well, what about Meryl Streep? You know, and Meryl told me that she was 40. When she turned 40, she instantly got 3 offers of parts to play witches, one after the other. And she told her husband, well, that's it. It's all over. We should go move wherever the kids want to go to school because my career is shot to hell forever. I have turned 40. And look what happened. So the moral is, I guess you have to be very, very, very talented. But I believe even in entertainment that the future, I believe that the future, having seen all the things I've seen, all I can say is I have faith that the future will be a finer and better place. I'll leave you with that.
Yeah. That is such a high note to wrap this up with. Thank you so much.
Good to you. Thank you, guys. This was great. It was great being here. Yeah.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was New York Times op-ed columnist Gail Collins, whose new book is No Stopping Us Now, A History of Older Women in America. She was joined in conversation by Inflection Point's Lauren Schiller. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Alex Espalay, Dan Folds, Carly Mari, and Aiden Nelson. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pimentuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.